Here now, ladies and gentlemen, is the regular morning roundup of news at home and in foreign countries. The news in Great Britain is reported now by John McVain from London.
This is London. The Admiralty today stated that British submarines have sunk two large enemy supply ships in the Mediterranean. News that the German battleship Tirpitz is back in the Norwegian port of Trondheim is causing the British to speculate on whether the Germans intend to launch a strong naval force into the Atlantic. With the Tirpitz is the pocket battleship Admiral Scheer, the cruiser Prince Eugen, thought to be damaged, and a number of destroyers. Even if the Prince Eugen is damaged, the rest of the German warships form a constant menace to Atlantic shipping and to the convoys going to Russia. The fact that the menace exists means that the British must keep strong naval forces ready to attack the German vessels if they move out of harbor. But there's always the chance that the German flotilla will slip through the guard in fog or bad weather. There's another thing the British are wondering and hoping about, the fact that something big seems to be starting in the Middle East. Early this morning, reports reached London that General Nye, vice chief of the Imperial General Staff, had arrived in Cairo with Sir Stafford Cripps, and that a big war council had been called there. Sir Stafford, all the British military leaders in the area, the British ambassador in Egypt, and Sir Walter Monckton, director of information, were reported as taking part. The British reasoned that only some move of far-reaching importance would make such a council necessary, and the evident haste of Mr. Churchill to get Mr. Casey out to Egypt as British Minister of State may be another pointer toward the possibility of a big German or British move in the Middle East in the near future. Trafalgar Square in London is the square where the statue of General Nelson broods over the memory of his great naval victory. The square had a modern nautical look today. In the center is the replica of a battleship's gun turret, and the model of a submarine conning tower loomed over the fountain. They were signs that the British capital today began its warship week. In the next 7 days, the people of London will try to raise the equivalent of $500 million for warships. The week is the climax of a British national savings campaign that began in October. The city of Exeter has increased its objective from about $2 million to nearly $3 million to replace the cruiser Exeter lost in the big sea battle off Java. One of today's London papers reports the impressions of an American reporter back in America after 2 years in Europe. It isn't until you hear about store windows filled with food and tobacco that you realize how gradually the British have come to accept a way of living that in comparison with America is a hard, lean way. New gas and electricity rationing is coming into effect here soon. There's been talk of cutting down the tobacco supply. Clothing is to be more strictly rationed with the introduction of the new utility suits for men. Getting a couple of eggs has become a thrilling experience for the housewife and even for her husband. People remember good meals for a long time. I know three people who succeeded in getting 20 cents worth of good steak for supper the other night, and they talked about it afterward as though it were a feast. A well-to-do businessman I was talking with the other night said, "At the office and at the club, food has taken the place of the weather in ordinary polite conversation. Men say, 'I had a nice fresh egg for breakfast today,' with the same air that they used to say, 'I made a killing in the stock market yesterday.'" This is John McVain in London, returning you to New York.
Now, here in the New York newsroom, we have reports from Moscow. And the latest Russian communique indicates that Red Army forces may be hammering with all they've got at the Nazi-held cities of Rzhev and Vyazma this morning. A Central Front dispatch tells of Russian troops battling for two large towns in this area, directly west of Moscow. The Russian units now engaged in that sector are credited with having advanced 150 miles since the start of the Russian winter offensive. They've retaken six cities and 2,500 villages since the German retreat from the capital began. Now, previous communiques indicated that Rzhev and Vyazma have been closely besieged. And Moscow also tells of Russian guerrilla fighters killing 1,000 Germans at Bryansk. That's the base of the German lines now holding the Russian frontal attack on Smolensk. Guerrilla bands are said to have entered the city to destroy German military stores. And Moscow declares that they even posted leaflets on German bulletin boards before returning to the Russian lines. Still other guerrilla detachments operating out of Leningrad are said to have wiped out 900 Germans and to have destroyed seven Nazi planes, 22 tanks, and 106 German trucks. Regular army men on the Leningrad front have overrun 10 more Nazi blockhouses in recent fighting, and they are said to have counted 455 German dead. Now, the Vichy radio says that Russian forces are fighting in the streets of Staraya Russa, the town below Leningrad, where the German 16th Army has been trapped for several weeks. And Vichy also says that Russian forces have broken through the fortifications at Kharkov, but that they've been thrown back by the Nazi garrisons after a bitter fight. And now let's hear about the fighting in the Pacific from our newsroom in San Francisco.
Now we take you to the Southwest Pacific. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Sidney Albright calling from Sydney. The time is 11:06 on Saturday evening. While the Japanese continue their bombings of distant Australian cities, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Curtin, announced the sinking of another enemy heavy cruiser, the main topic of discussion of the man in the street and of the press was centered on the arrival in Melbourne today of General MacArthur. His unpretentious khaki uniform was in striking contrast to the colorful array of uniforms worn by the numerous Allied leaders who participated in the reception. Amidst the thunder of thousands of cheering Australians, MacArthur proceeded along the crowded streets to his hotel, concluding the most enthusiastic welcome ever extended in this country to a representative of the United States. Further evidence of the Australians' high regard for the hero of Bataan and of their sentiment for America and the American people. On February 2nd, history was made in Melbourne when the first time on Australian soil the flag of another nation was unfurled over foreign troops, friendly or otherwise. During the formal ceremony, the Star-Spangled Banner was played, followed by a touching speech of welcome by the commander of the Royal Park Camp. Today's spontaneous reception for General MacArthur was indeed a fitting climax. Meanwhile, the soldiers are making themselves right at home. They have taken over one city, lock, stock, and barrel. The name of it has already been changed to Yanktown, unofficially, of course. A Midwestern sergeant has just been married to an Australian girl. Many more marriages are reported for the very near future. When I asked the assistance of a railway porter, he replied, "I'll do anything for an American." I could go on indefinitely with such expressions of sentiment, but we'll conclude with the words of a department store girl who waited on me and helped refurnish my lost wardrobe, which was left behind in Java. After speaking only a few words, she spotted me for an American and said, "The Americans are doing such a wonderful job, I could kiss everyone I see. I now return you to San Francisco."
From the San Francisco newsroom, here are the latest reports from the Far East. The first revelation that the Chinese and British forces have joined hands against the common Japanese invaders in Burma came today with reports of battles in the vicinity of Tonggu, 150 miles north of Rangoon on the road to Mandalay. Over 700 Japanese casualties were said to have been inflicted on the enemy by the British near Tonggu, while the Chinese met an invading force at Pu about 50 miles south of Tonggu, and the foe suffered an additional 100 casualties there. Although Japanese patrols reached Letappadan, only about halfway on the northwestern road toward Prome, the main body of the enemy in that area was still south of Taiki in the Nipponese two-pronged drive to the north. In northeastern Burma, near Mongtung, Chinese troops were reported to have again repelled Thai invasion thrusts, which were actuated by the Japanese in a further attempt to invade the Shan states. On the Irrawaddy front, the Japanese have not yet attempted to launch a general offensive. It was said, however, that possibly they had occupied the small port of Basin, but nothing was known definitely. Meantime, the American volunteer group was active in harassing the Japanese, dropping incendiaries from planes among the thousands of elephants the Japanese are using for transport in an effort to effect a stampede. The Americans are based at Mandalay. The enemy's propaganda machine was hard at work again. A dispatch from New Delhi said Japanese-controlled radio stations are sending out appeals to the Indian population to follow the example of the Burmese and revolt against the British. American bomber crews, seasoned by 15 weeks of fighting against overwhelming odds in the Far East, today are taking a heavy toll of Japanese ships, planes, and manpower in smashing offensive raids on Nipponese invasion spearheads now threatening northern Australia. Even incomplete official reports on activities of United States airmen since the fall of Java indicate that the rate of destruction of enemy ships and bases is greater in Australia than it was in the East Indies. And that's the news from San Francisco. Now we take you across the continent to Claude Mahoney in the newsroom in Washington.
Good morning. Senator Thomas says there won't be any labor checking legislation at this session of Congress unless things get much worse. But the people in the House who have the Smith-Vinson bill to throw out the 40-hour week, ban the closed shop, and outlaw strikes, they don't give up that easily. Mr. Vinson said testimony before the Naval Affairs Committee where the bill is, this testimony has made a good showing for the need of legislation. There's been a great deluge of letters and telegrams from all over the country, and now labor leaders are demanding an investigation of what they call an organized propaganda drive against labor. Philip Murray, the CIO leader, said the drive of propaganda started in the Southern States Industrial Council. And William Green, the AF-AVAIL man, says it started in Oklahoma. But wherever it started, it had the congressman on the run for a little while. And it was important enough to cause the president and his administration leaders to issue statements that called for retention of the 40-hour week. And there are two big problems, though, serious problems, that have not been solved. One of them is the proposal to abolish double time for Sunday work, and the other is the adoption of incentive or bonus and piecework plans to step up production. Speaking for the CIO, Murray said the question of double time must be settled by unions and management, and added that it's a matter of contract. He said his union, the CIO Steel Union, has no double time provisions in its contracts. And both Green and Murray deny that there are any slowdowns at all in factories, and they say that the production efficiency of labor is now at the highest peak in history. The question of war profits, and that phrase has a familiar ring if you're old enough to remember the last war. That question's a big one in Congress. The Naval Affairs Committee of the House has proposed a limitation of 6%, but the Army and Navy are said not to approve of that. Undersecretary of the Navy Forrestal and Undersecretary of War Patterson have suggested that profits could be curbed more effectively through tax laws. But Representative Vinson, chairman of the Naval Affairs Committee, says there's nothing to prevent companies from padding their expense sheets and thus concealing profits. Meanwhile, the Ways and Means Committee of the House, which in the last analysis is the body that has the responsibility for raising this tax money, that committee is studying the messages it is receiving, demanding a tightening up of taxes on excess profits. And the committee investigating Robert Guthrie's accusations about the dollar-a-year men in the government, his accusations that they retained a little too much interest in their old businesses back home, this committee is listening to a lot of people on Guthrie's side just now, and they all tell the same story. There was a lag in conversion to war work, they say, substantiating the story Guthrie told when he resigned from the Textile Committee of the Production Board. But they haven't named any names yet, and they haven't named any specific factory, firm, or corporation. They haven't accused anybody directly of failure to cooperate. And they're going to call witnesses, many of whom soon will be on the other side. We hear rumors that President Roosevelt's considering a tour of the nation this summer, a sort of a grassroots visit to the people who are out on the production front. It would be a kind of morale tour to boost war spirits and tie the nation up a little more closely in their job of whipping the Axis. And that's all from Washington at this time.
That's the morning's news, ladies and gentlemen, as reported by John McVain from London, Sidney Albright in Australia, Claude Mahoney in Washington, and the newsrooms in San Francisco and New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.